Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 317 for May 22nd, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
At the end of the day, the only thing that's changed is the people and the philosophy. The distillery is still the same. And it's the distillery and the wonderful setup and layout that the Harveys designed that determines the weight and the floral nature and the elegance of the spirit.
That's Mark Rainier, the managing director of Brooke Laddie. This is Brooke Laddie's Day at the Isla Festival of Malt and Music. And it's even more special this year than usual because it marks 10 years since the distillery's revival in 2001. More with Mark Rainier and the Bard of Brooke Laddie and whiskey in general, the one and only Robin Lang, later on. Also, a special look at the art and craft of coopering with one of Ireland's few remaining coopers, Middleton's Ger Buckley. There are also a couple of surprises in store, and Ger figures into one of them, but you're going to have to keep listening for the details. I'll also have the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. It's not often that one messes with an iconic brand, let alone the world's best-selling whiskey, but that's exactly what Brown-Forman has done with Jack Daniel's. Let's be specific now. They did not touch the whiskey inside the bottle, but Jack Daniel's is getting a slightly redesigned bottle and a new label that's designed to clear up some of what Brown-Forman cites as the clutter that built up over the years. For instance, the reference to Lem Motlow, proprietor, is gone now, along with the reference to Lynchburg's population of 561, and the line, bottled at the distillery. Turns out that was changed because the current bottling hall for Jack Daniel's is about a mile or so from the actual distillery now. You'll see the new design at retailers by July, and I have to point out that our completely unscientific survey on the Whiskey Cast Facebook page was unanimous. No one liked the new design. It's the first weekend of the Isla Festival of Malt and Music, and we're starting to find out more about the various festival bottlings. We've already heard details a couple of weeks ago on Art Begg's bottling. Lagavulin's went on sale Saturday and is probably sold out already as I'm recording this. It's a 13-year-old malt selected by warehouseman Ian MacArthur from a refill butt and bottled at a cask strength 51% ABV. Just 588 bottles were available. Kalila's goes on sale Monday with 600 bottles drawn from a bodega cask selected by distillery manager Billy Stitchell and bottled at 64.3%. Mark Rainier will tell us about Brooke Laddie's special later on. Meanwhile, there are 140 new special spirits on the Spirit Journal's annual list of the top 140 spirits in the world. Editor F. Paul Packolt and managing editor Sue Woodley also retired five longtime fixtures from the list this year and placed them in a new Hall of Fame.
We're trying to bring in some new items, Mark, and for the last, for 2010 and 2011, Sue and I have been focusing quite a bit on the craft distillation movement. For better or for worse, in the United States, and examining as many items, different spirits from different parts of the country as we could. And much to our delight, there were several that we actually included in our roundup of what we feel are the 140 best spirits in the world right now. And so that was certainly a new point. Going over and on top of that even is our creation of the Spirit Journal Hall of Fame, which is a new endeavor for us because we wanted to. Some products have year after year after year been just repeatedly cited by us as the best products. Case in point, Cointreau. Case in point, Highland Park 18-year-old single malt from the Orkney Islands. They just appear perennially because their quality standards are so extraordinary. So we decided this year to take a different slant, create a Hall of Fame where they would basically, where five products every year would be taken and inducted into the Hall of Fame, basically retiring them from the yearly rigors of the 140 top spirits in the world list, and just saying, okay, these are iconic brands that have earned a right through longevity and continued consistent quality to start a new level. Basically, you know, we rate from 1 to 5 stars, but basically almost putting them on a 6-star level now, just saying these are iconic brands, they are total benchmarks, and elevating those. So it's kind of a two-pronged attack this year, introducing some great craft distillates, but also instituting a new level, a new degree of wonderfulness and accomplishment by instituting the Spirit Journal Hall of Fame.
I want to ask you more about that Hall of Fame and the top spirit in the world in just a second, but first of all, if you can run down a couple of the whiskeys that made it into, from those craft distilleries that you mentioned, that made it into the top 140.
Well, I don't know if, Phil Pritchard's double barrel bourbon, which I actually think is the best distillate Phil Pritchard has made in the years that he's been running his small operation. And I was really happy to do that because I've long admired Phil as a real pioneer in this area. And to be honest, really kind of overlooked by many people, I think. And so that was a big inclusion for us. We tried to, because the spirits list crosses all categories, I believe Phil was actually, or no, actually there were two. There was Chip Tate's Baby True Blue Bourbon, also from Texas, that made it. So those were two. But some of the others were liqueurs and vodkas and just trying to cover as many categories as possible of excellence.
Now back to that Top Spirits competition for a second. For the last several years, you've rated Highland Park 18 as the top spirit in the world, right?
Since 2005, Mark, yeah. It's one, and I, you know, I guess maybe you have known me for many years. Maybe it's just I'm a boring personality. But the reality is, you know, I think Highland Park 18 just continues to be a pinnacle achievement. Certainly not just for whiskey, but I just think for distilling in general. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people disagree with me. They might think some other whiskeys are certainly worthy of being number one, and I've actually kind of done that this year by naming a new number one since Highland Park 18 has been placed into the pantheon of spirits, the SJ Hall of Fame. I've actually named an American spirit this year as number one.
And?
And that is George T. Stagg, cask strength, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, but one in particular, and that was from the Antique Collection put out by Buffalo Trace, but for last year, 2010. And, you know, why is that number one? Am I crazy to put in a cask strength whiskey? Perhaps, but I also think I view it, Mark, as a testament to American whiskey distilling, which I think is as good as any place in the world right now. And by citing a whiskey, George T. Stagg, that has for the last 5-6 years just been a continual icon and a continuing beacon of quality and interpretation, I just felt it was long overdue. To be honest, last year I was very, very close to naming William LaRue Weller as the number one whiskey in the world. But I backed off. I wanted to give Buffalo Trace Distillery, who makes both of them, one more year. And the reality is they just have done a fantastic job, and Sue and I felt that George T. Stagg was really deserving of the Best Spirit in the World moniker.
Now, I'm not going to say you're crazy for naming a cask strength whiskey as the best one.
Please do, Mark.
But what I do want to ask you, though, is are you setting yourself up for a new number one next year, given that the George T. Stagg is an annual release that changes from year to year, and different release years do vary from time to time? Are you setting yourself up to have to name a new number one next year if, for instance, this year's Stagg doesn't equal the quality of last year's?
Yeah, and you are right on the mark. Yes, there is that possibility, and actually I would say it could be a probability. But there's so many, as you and I both know, because we're together a lot and we taste a lot together. There are so many great whiskeys out right now. I mean, the number two for this year is Glenmorangie Nectar d'Or from the Northern Highlands of Scotland. Number three is Four Roses 2010 limited edition small batch. That also is barrel strength. Number five is Parker's Heritage Collection, fourth edition. So within the top five of the top 140 spirits in the world, again, as Sue and I see them, four of the top five are whiskeys, and three of them are from the United States. And here I think, well, maybe, maybe Four Roses will get the number one nod next year. There's so many new bottlings coming out of Scotland and Ireland. Maybe those will take it. I tend towards whiskey just because I believe without any doubt, after reviewing over 21,000 spirits since 1989, that whiskey is by far and away the most complex of all spirits. So I like the fact that when a whiskey is talking to me elegantly and yet with true multi-dimensional complexity, you know, it's got to be cited. It's got to be. Am I ever going to have a vodka as number one? You know,
if you do, then I will say you're crazy.
I tend to doubt it. I really tend to doubt it. Though I will tell you that the Boyd and Blair craft vodka from Pennsylvania, potato vodka from Pennsylvania, made number 22. And it was the highest rated vodka. So, I've never been a vodka fan, but, you know, maybe via the avenue of the craft distillers, maybe we'll be seeing vodkas that are truly world-class. And the fact is, Boyd and Blair is really a world-class product.
In addition to the Highland Park 18, Middleton Very Rare was the other whiskey to go into the Spirit Journal Hall of Fame. The June issue of the Spirit Journal will go out this week. Now, you and Shand would love to see a whiskey of his go into Paul's Hall of Fame one day. Of course, Ewan is the owner of Duncan Taylor & Company and has been working for several years on building a distillery of his own in the Highlands town of Huntley. There have been a number of rumors over the last few months that Ewan had given up on the project, and I tracked him down on his mobile phone this week to check out the rumors.
Well, the status is that we've changed the actual configuration of the distillery. It was going to be split into really two parts, and we've reconfigured it so that everything is incorporated in one, and that helps environmentally. It's perfect because it means that there's no heat loss between the processes, and that was one of our biggest areas. Plus, the building we discovered needed a lot of underpinning work. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually take the building down and rebuild it exactly the same as it was, but we're going to move it forward a little bit, about 15 foot forward, and that'll allow us to get a little bit more room. But all of this meant that we had to go back to planning, and because of that, you know how planners are. Sorry, as you can hear, I'm driving at the moment. Well, I'm no longer driving. I'm getting out the car. So we've had to do quite a lot of, you know, reconfiguration. We've got different structural engineers then as well, more attuned to distilleries, and I think we've got it right this time. So hopefully we've got it right.
When do you hope to begin construction?
Well, the planning process will take about 3 months, our grants are still in place, which is great news. So there's no problems there. So we'll look. You know, it's probably going to be about October, November. Realistically, October, November. But it's definitely going to go ahead. I mean, there's no way that it's not going to go ahead. So whoever said it isn't doesn't know what they're talking about.
Okay. Anything new on the whiskey front as far as new releases that you want to talk about?
We've got a few things coming up. Some oldies and goldies, Lochside and stuff like that, that we're looking to bottle. We always come up with something.
By the way, Ewan has named a new CEO for Duncan Taylor. Scott Watson will be responsible for the company's day-to-day operations, and that will free up Ewan for the distillery project and his goal of building up Duncan Taylor's international sales, especially for the Black Bowl blended scotch. Other personnel moves to report around the industry. Louisa Young is leaving her post as sales director at Aaron to join Tullibardine Distillery. Longtime Dewars brand ambassador Ewan Gunn has joined Diageo as a global brand ambassador, and Brooklady sales director Andrew Gray has left the company. Finally, Edrington Group's acquisition last year of the venerable Cutty Sark blended scotch brand is taking another step. Edrington has changed its U.S. importer for Cutty from Sky Spirits to Remy Cointreau USA. Now, the move was not unexpected, since Remy's U.S. unit already serves as the importer of record for Edrington's famous Grouse, the McAllen, and Highland Park scotches. Edrington is planning to relaunch Cutty Sark later this year with several new releases. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Earlier I mentioned that I have a couple of surprises for you this time around. I hinted at that earlier this week on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. In addition to the couple of smart alecks who asked if I was going to sing this week's episode, and that might actually have brought on the apocalypse and the end of the world, well, Matt Waller had this to say. Finally, you're going with my idea of Everyone Wins a Trip to Fayes Isle 2011. This is going to be so good, I'll just go check my passport is valid. And Evan Chapman piped up that his passport is still good for 8 more months. Guys, keep dreaming. That's not going to happen. However, here is surprise number one. You may remember that we had a health scare in my family earlier this year when my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. The chemo and radiation worked, the tumor is gone, and we're all breathing a bit easier now. But I thought, given that, it might be fun to do something special for Father's Day, which is coming up in a few weeks. But in this case, you may get the presents. Our sponsors have agreed to provide prize packs that I'll be giving away at random on Father's Day, June 19th. And I'll mention some of the items each week between now and then. We have some travel bags from Johnny Walker and the Glenrothes, along with some golf goodies from Glenmorangie and our other sponsors as well. The question, how do you enter? All you have to do is either subscribe to the WhiskeyCast email newsletter through the website, like WhiskeyCast on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter at WhiskeyCast. You can also leave feedback on the WhiskeyCast pages for the podcast and the iPhone app in the Apple Music Store, or the Android app at the Android Market. And if you do all five, well, you've got 5 chances to win. I really want to thank our sponsors for helping make this possible, and I want to thank you again for your support over the last few months. Now let's look at some of the emails of the week, and they're brought to you this week by Highland Park. The fact that you're listening to this episode, as I hinted a few seconds ago, means the world did not end on Saturday, as a religious group had predicted. But that didn't stop many WhiskeyCast listeners from opening some of their favorite bottles Friday night, just in case. The Scotch Dude said on Twitter that he's keeping it simple and starting at Talisker 10 and ending with Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Snibble said Beaumont or Ardbeg Yugadal. Quote M, unquote, said, all that I own, and I might steal some bottles I've never tried. And Alain Chiasson said, all of it, can't take it with you. Mike Sumner, 1328, said, Highland Park, 50-year-old, if he had some. That'll make this guy happy, since the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Let's look ahead to some of the events coming up in June. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Australian chapter will hold members' tastings on June 3rd in Brisbane, the 8th in Sydney, and on the 9th and 15th in Melbourne. The folks at Bayway's World of Liquors and O'Connell's Restaurant in Jersey City, New Jersey, are teaming up for a benefit to support the Soccer Learning Center's Autism Project on June 9th. Woodford Reserve's final Bourbon Academy class of the year is June 11th at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky. Amrut's Ashok Chokalingham will lead a tasting of his whiskeys at Nichols & Perks in Starbridge, England on the 17th. Whiskey Live at the Games will be in the Chicago suburb of Itasca, Illinois on June 17th and 18th. And the next Whiskey Classic tasting cruise will be on June 23rd in Washington, D.C. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Become a friend of Laphroaig today and claim your own square foot of Isla. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. Earlier this year, we toured the Brown-Forman Cooperage in Louisville, where they make 2,400 whiskey barrels a day. The art of coopering has been around for centuries, but it's almost died out as machines took over most of the work. Now, many of the guys at the Brown-Forman Cooperage could build barrels by hand if they had to, but Jer Buckley learned how to do it the hard way at an early age, and he still does it. He's one of two coopers at Ireland's Middleton Distillery.
I'm fifth generation now. When I started my time first, I served most of my time, when I say time, my apprenticeship to my father. My uncle worked here as a cooper as well at that time. Previous to that, my father served his time with his uncle. And further back, going back as coopers, we worked in breweries, in distilleries. And I've been able to trace back five generations. It may go back further because it would have been handed down father to son, but that's as far back as I've gotten the records to date.
And your family was actually part of the Dublin Coopers Guild at one point, right?
Not exactly the Dublin Coopers Guild. We had our own Cork Guild as such. Two of them were linked, but the Cork Cooper Society had a guild, and the Dublin Cooper Society, which was the oldest guild in the world, it was the first to be recognised by King of England going back to almost 15th century, which sadly is no longer with us, but they've been able to trace their ancestry back in that guild over 400 years. So it has a long history.
And the guilds were really the dominant force in coopering back then, right?
The guilds were the dominant force, an early form of trade union, an early form of quality control, an early form of protecting their members and looking after their welfare. I know a lot of members in Cork in particular would have got a steerage paid by the guild to emigrate to America and maybe Australia and other parts. So when work dried up for coopers or whatever, a benefit was found to help them move on. In regards to quality control, you had to, for your example, make your staves out of quarter sawn timber. If you use plank timber, you could be severely reprimanded by the guild. You may have to serve under a master again. So it ensured that once your barrels were made and passed on to distilleries or whatever, with the blessing of the guild, that a certain standard was maintained.
And back then, being a member of the Cooper's Guild meant that you could pass your trade on down to your sons or daughters, as the case may be, and continue in the generation and provide for generations back then, right?
Yes, I mean, it was very much a father-to-son trade because it was so very well paid, so very well skilled, even though it was so very, very hard work as well, that you would have got your sons into the guild. It was very rare to try and get an outsider into the guild. It was very much protected because, as I say, it was so highly paid and so, you know, such a great skill to take wherever you went.
Tell me about the early days back here when you were not the only cooper, but when there were a team of coopers working at this distillery.
Well, when I first started serving my time with my dad, there was 18 coopers. The noise and the dust was intense. Looking back at it now, it kind of scares me a bit to think it was so noisy, but you just walked away in it. What we call here in Ireland the crack, or the fun that goes on, the practical jokes that were played on coopers. Like one joke we used to play constantly on the same cooper. He used to never cop onto it. We'd put his hammer and his driver into a cask that he was working on, give him somebody else's hammer and driver to finish the cask, And then when it was finished, he would knock the cask and hear the clunk of the hammer and driver and have to reopen the cask to the howls of laughter of everybody in the shop. So it was great fun, great camaraderie among the fellow coopers. Not always see eye to eye, but on the whole, we were kind of like a brotherhood. So, you know, that aspect of coopering I miss, where having so many other coopers with you. If you ran into some kind of problem with a cask, or if you were making something new with a cask, you had somebody to fall back on and ask. That I don't have anymore either, so I kind of miss that side of things. But glad to say that I did serve my time to my dad, and so I have fond memories of working with my dad closely. Sometimes when you get home, wouldn't be always on the best of terms, maybe, and then you'd have to go home after maybe giving out to you and work for doing something the wrong way. But, you know, looking back, and I'm glad that I had that experience.
How much fun was it to work here back in the day when you were working with those as part of that team of 18? With the practical jokes and the crack, but also the ability to make something with your hands out of wood and take it and shape it and essentially mold that wood to what you wanted it to be.
Well, the great thing when you have that many coopers in a shop, you have different opinions that you can consult. That when you're making for an apprentice piece, say a small tub, for example, one of the apprentice pieces I made was an oval coal scuttle. Because oval casks would have been traditional to ships because they could have been stored differently and maybe operate. So the ship's cask might have been an oval butt cask for water. So when you're making an oval piece like that, you would maybe consult different opinions as to how it's going to be shaped. And you would learn not just from your master, who was my dad, but from other coopers. So you kind of benefit from a big workshop of all the different skills, different ideas, different techniques. When coopers worked ahead, it worked with different rhythm, so different style. And it's kind of like, best respect, if you take a golfer, not every golf swing is the same. Say if you take Jim Furyk with that swing, I mean, coopers were the same. They had totally different swings with a hammer and so on. So all those memories keep flooding back to me now, and I miss that. And it's great to have those memories and maybe pass them on.
And you can tell a cooper's hammer by where they strike it, right?
You could. One aspect where you could tell a barrel by who worked on it was the type of riveting done on the cask. We here in Cork always put a diamond shaped on the rivets, but everyone had their own shape. So you could almost distinguish a cask by its rivets and you would know who worked on that cask. Much like a mason, the way he would dress a brick. Would have a different chisel effect. Coopers were the same. Now, it's only coopers could identify each cask as to who maybe worked on it. On top of that, you would always mark your cask with a mark. And my own particular mark was from my father and his father, which is number one, as it turns out. But other coopers had their initials from their names, such as L for Lee, such as F for Finbar, and so on. So you always marked your work because if your work failed later on, you had to stand over it and maybe do it for free, or maybe got reprimanded because your work failed. So once you finished with your barrel, it better be good enough to take whiskey afterwards.
And tell me about the tools, because we see in modern cooperages now it's all done by machine, but back in the day you were doing it by hand, right?
Yes. I mean, the coopers I would have worked at when I first started had made everything by hand. They had no machinery whatsoever. No such thing as even a bandsaw. So the tools, which I'm still lucky to possess, such as the knives, axe, were very sought after. And it was traditional that when a cooper served his time and came out of his time, that his master would present him with a set of tools to carry on his trade. Because back then you served a 7-year apprenticeship. You were probably skilled enough after maybe 4 or 5 years to make a cask. And the last maybe year, 2 years, you served for the master so that he would earn enough money back from having taught you your trade. And so it was quite an effect to get a full kit of tools when you finished. The other main thing that would happen when you served your time and finished your apprenticeship is we had a tradition both here and in Britain of what we call trussing. Where you would put the apprentice cooper into a cask, usually a large enough cask such as a butt. You would pour charcoal, water, everything that was around the place, shavings, everything on top of him, and completely destroy everything he was wearing. And then he would roll the cask up and down the shop as an initiation ceremony to welcome him into the trade. Usually when that would happen, your relatives would come in, your mother would come in, your sisters. It was a big celebration. So that tradition, it goes back centuries as well. So there's a lot of heritage, tradition, skills, love of the craft. I mean, you had to love doing what you were doing and work with oak because it was physical. But for me personally, my favourite wood would always be oak. I do enjoy working with other woods when I do wood turning or cabinet making, but oak is number one.
You're going to get to revive that tradition of trussing, aren't you? Because you're going to get an apprentice here fairly soon, right?
Yes, indeed. Not too far away from in the near future, we hope to have an apprentice. So maybe in 4 to 5 years' time, we'll renew the trussing tradition. We probably won't inform our safety officer on the day what we're doing. But I think it's important to keep up tradition and keep a sense of culture in the whole craft as well.
And this really is a traditional craft. I mean, we've talked about it going back centuries. The barrels in this shop and the tools that you're using, tell me about the hammer, first of all, that you're using now, because that has a story behind it that really is a really good tale of how this business and how this craft goes on, right?
Yes, I mean, like for me, working with that hammer, it wasn't my father's, it was a very good friend of mine, a good long work colleague who I received a lot of advice and training from over time. It gave me that hammer on leaving because I treasured it, because I understood the value of having served two generations, provided a living for two generations. The handle wearing so thin that it's almost unusable, but the technique that both Coopers had using that hammer was so good that they could use a thin hammer and not wear the hammer whatsoever. The other thing with coopering that I often say to people, there are no DIY coopers. It's not something you can just pick up from a book and start making a barrel. You do really have to serve an apprenticeship to learn the trade. And to have the tools as well are so specialized, such as that hammer, such as the adze, such as the axe, the knives. You know, it's not something you can just read a book and do, you know.
You could probably make a stave if you really got lucky, but you couldn't actually get staves to hold liquid, could you?
Well, the problem you're going to run into straight away is the angles of the stave. And that is one of the true skills of coopering, is to be able to look at a stave, to be able to eye it up and down and make sure that the angle is right. Because if you get the angles of the stave wrong, you're going to get a leak. Then you're going to have to maybe redress all the staves and you're back to making the whole thing again. And then you're going to have to add staves and you're running into all sorts of problems. So that's one of the harder skills to learn, is to know just by looking at a stave that it's correct. And that has to be taught. It can't really be learned from a book or anything else. And that's a skill that, glad to say, we'll be passing on to future generations.
Tell me about your trussing. When you completed your apprenticeship, tell me about that day when you finished your apprenticeship and you finally became a full-fledged cooper.
Well, for me, it wasn't the same aspect, because back in that stage, coopering was in danger a lot. So the trussing wasn't on the big traditional method that it was when earlier generations. And we, as coopers, went through a lot of turmoil at that time, and the craft was dying, and economically it was struggling to survive. Luckily for me, that the Cork coopers managed to hold out and maintain a job here in Middleton. So I didn't have the traditional trussing with the charcoal and the water and everything else. I managed to escape it, but I can assure you the next apprentice won't escape it.
How many coopers are there active today in Ireland? I know it's you, and I think each of the other distilleries has one.
Yes, here in Middleton we have two coopers, myself and Donal O'Regan. In Bushmills they have a cooper. The old cooper that used to work there, Watson, sadly passed away some time ago, and they've retaken on a cooper they used to have working for them. In the other cooperage or distillery in Ireland, Cooley, they have, from what I can gather, a Scottish cooper. So in a sense, there are three Irish coopers left, which is a sad state of affairs in one respect, because around the turn of the 19th century, there was something like 11,000 coopers in the country. because Coopers would have made everything that was used from butter churns to containers to for apples, for fish, for, and then the wet side of coopering, the whiskey, the breweries and so on would have had Coopers. So it was a huge demand because it was the main container for shipping anything. But the good news is we have an apprentice coming.
So there'll be a fourth Irish Cooper at some point.
There will be a fourth, and maybe even possibly more than that as time goes on, because we're doing so well here in Jameson and Middleton that there's further demand for more Coopers. So with the growth of Jameson, the growth of Coopers.
Your function basically now is to repair barrels as needed, but you can build them yourself, obviously, and you can craft a handcraft a stave to replace one that's messed up in a barrel, but the main function is repair now and fixing up barrels, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, because the quality of the cask that we buy in is so good and so high that we've managed to reduce the number of repairs we have. For example, every cask is never left out in the elements. It's under cover from day one when it comes in. When it's shipped to warehouse, it's shipped in covered lorries so it doesn't get wet. So the condition of casks, it has improved enormously. We don't get rusty hoops anymore or anything like that. But occasionally when we do get a broken stave, usually in a butt, because timber has defects and weaknesses and can give way under pressure at times. So I do repair butts in a traditional manner. It has to be done manually in the same way that my ancestors would have done it, in the same way the Romans repaired casks or the Gauls before them. So very little has changed in that respect. Maybe the tools have improved over the centuries in coming to steel from bronze. But in the way of, it's kind of daunting to think that, you know, you're still doing something that was done 2,000 years ago.
One final question. I've seen cooperages, modern-day cooperages, can build 2,400 barrels in a day. How long would it take you to build one barrel?
Well, traditionally, if you were making a butt, you would have made 2.5 butts a week or 5 butts a fortnight, and that's starting from straight timber, straight hoops. You would have made your hoops, your heads, everything. So it was quite labor intensive in that respect, and that's probably why I had to get mechanized. It was just too costly to make casks, and that's why traditionally if you owned a cask, you were considered kind of rich because a cask was so expensive to get made. Now you would have got, as I said, maybe butter churn made and various things like that, and they would have been very precious items in any household. So, as I say, from that regard, it would have been expensive to have a cask made.
And it would take you probably 2 to 3 days to make one now?
It would take me 2 or 3 days. It's not a skill I've kept up over the years because, as I say, I do mostly repairing. But I do get all sorts of casks in here. Sometimes a small little 5-gallon cask comes in needing repair. I sometime ago repaired a butter churn from scratch. I had to make a whole new cask for it because there was nothing left of it and refit the hardware to it, which the owner was very happy with. But so sometimes it's necessary, and I think it's important to know how to make a cask a traditional way and from scratch. And that's a tradition I tend to keep up.
Now here's the second surprise, and it's something we've never done before. Jerry was kind enough to not only share his story with us, but show us some of those old tools and just how he uses them in the debut of WhiskeyCast HD. It's the first of what will become an ongoing series of WhiskeyCast video podcasts. You can find it at YouTube. Just search for WhiskeyCast, and you can look for WhiskeyCast HD soon in the iTunes Music Store. Of course, it'll also be available at the WhiskeyCast website, and I'd love to have your feedback and suggestions for future episodes of WhiskeyCast HD. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry, non-chill filtered, full Highland character. Now, as I'm recording this, it was a year ago that I was on Islay for the Islay Festival of Malt and Music, and particularly at the Brook Laddie party in the clubhouse at the Port Charlotte campground, followed by the infamous Moonlight Croquet match fueled by Brook Laddie Black Art. This year's party is even more special, and I wish I could be there this weekend. That's because Brook Laddie is celebrating the 10th anniversary of its revival. Managing Director Mark Rainier has been busy getting ready for the weekend, but spent a few minutes on the phone with me Friday. Tell me about what it was like on that day 10 years ago when you guys fired up the still for the first time.
The most extraordinary emotional roller coaster I've ever been through. I remember seeing Jim before the gates opened, and we looked at each other, and I tell you, there were tears in our eyes. It was just the most highly charged emotional event I've ever been through. It took me 2 days to recover, just the emotional intensity of it all. And it really, it was coming down to the fact that, you know, would it work or wouldn't it? It was really down to the wire stuff.
How have things gone in that 10 years? Because I know it was nip and tuck a few times, and I know that there are times when you guys were releasing stuff that you might not have always wanted to release, but you had to release it to make payroll and do things. But was it all worth it in the end 10 years ago, 10 years now?
Well, I'm not quite sure about what you just said just then. Yes, of course, it's difficult getting something off the ground and getting it going. You know, we bought some stock. You know, we bottled that stock. We released that stock. We had a big gap in the stock which we had to overcome at one point. You know, which, you know, when the distillery was shut and there was nothing there, we took the decision to remove. For example, you know, star bottlings like the 10-year-olds and stuff, because we didn't actually have any 10-year-olds to sell. We could have pretended, you know, down-aged stuff and done all sorts of things, but we didn't. We took the decision that, you know, like the 20-year-old, when the first 20-year-old was incredibly well received, and when it went, we had to wait 4 years until we had some more 20-year-old to release. So I think the fact of doing it with integrity and honesty and openness made it more difficult for us to do it, but we took that moral high ground because we think it's very important. It goes behind everything that we do, the traceability and openness and authenticity of what we do. So yeah, sure, it was difficult at the start. You have a lot of overheads and costs and expenses, and you're starting from zero revenue. So sure, it's difficult. You know, as time goes by, we start getting to a point where our own stocks come online. We start getting, you know, the volumes that we distilled coming online, which means that we can sort of readjust our strategy to where we would like to be, which is a more precise range of bottlings that cover the different attributes that we've been working on, you know, Islay grown barley or organic barley, Infinity, Black Art, you know, the different characteristics that we've been working towards. And it means that we've got more depth in those bottlings too. So it's very much a coming of age. As far as 10-year-old whiskey is concerned, 10-year-old Brookladdy, that comes out later in the year. But I mean, to be honest, you know, we one of the things we've discovered in this period is that age is actually pretty irrelevant. In certain markets, a 10-year-old is essential, monopoly markets, for example. But I mean, is a 10-year-old better than a 9-year-old or 11.5-year-old or a 13-year-old? It's one of those standard things we accept, that these 10, 15, 20-year age statements. But, you know, we've proven over this period, getting over the hole in our stock, the age is actually not the important thing. It's the quality of the whiskey. It's how you distill it. The slowness of distillation, the quality of the raw ingredients, the barley, the quality of the wood that you use. These things are far more important than age. You know, we've released Octomore each time at 5 years of age, deliberately. You know, last year it won the best peated whiskey in the world. We've released 3-year-old X4, quadruple distilled whiskey, which came fifth out of 126 whiskies in the Edinburgh Festival. We've demonstrated clearly that if you do these things properly, with integrity and honesty, you can make whiskey so much better at a much earlier stage. And it sort of belies that whole thing of age statements as being, you know, pretty worthless.
What are you guys doing this weekend to celebrate? I know it's also the first weekend of the Islay Festival too.
Well, we do our usual thing. We have our sort of evening tomorrow down at Portmore for the distillery guys and for our farmers and our contractors, you know, as a sort of thank you. Then we have our open day that starts roughly at 12 o'clock and goes through to 6. Well, you know, you've been here. It's a very convivial day. It's an islanders' day. There's obviously visitors from overseas that join in too, but it's primarily for the elites of the island to come and say hello. It's a day for the guys here at the distillery to show off a bit about their distillery. And that's what we'll do. Lots of drams, lots of music, and lots of conviviality. It's a very laid back, easy going thing.
As we're talking, I'm looking over at my bottle of Isla Barley 2004 from last year's festival. What is this year's Fage bottling?
Two bottlings. It's a pair. The theme is revolution. The coup d'etat that was us taking over the distillery, much to the chagrin, perhaps, of the industry. We have two bottlings. One is the very last of the old regime, the ancien regime. So that's one of the bottlings. And the other is one of the first of our bottlings. They're both in silver tins, plain silver tins. The ethos behind this is that they're both bourbon matured. They're both 46%. They're both obviously natural whiskey. It's really a celebration of the passing from one regime to the next, because at the end of the day, the only thing that's changed are the people and the philosophy. The distillery is still the same. And it's the distillery and the wonderful setup and layout that the Harveys designed that determines the weight and the floral nature and the elegance of the spirit. We are just a different regime. So the idea is, it's not a showing off, you know, one against the other. It's a celebration of the past and a welcoming of a new era. So you know, for that reason, they are. A pair to demonstrate continuity. That's the point. The September, when we release our obligatory 10-year-old, that will be a celebration of the future. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. While I've got you on the phone, what's going on with Murray McDavid? Because I know there's been a lot of questions about the future there. Put it in terms for us, what you can say publicly. What is the future for the Murray McDavid line?
Well, I mean, Murray McDavid has expanded in all shapes and sizes and directions, and we wanted to get it back to how it used to be, which is a far more focused brand. We're also conscious of the fact that, you know, a lot of the bulk stocks out there these days is not really as interesting as it used to be. So we want to sort of, you know, rather than trying to offer everything to everybody, we want to sort of retrench it into a more focused prestige bottlings rather than you know, anything under the sun. So it's a refocusing back to its original ethos.
What are the new bottlings that you're releasing under that line, or that you know about right now? Since I'm asking you to do this from memory,
there'll be some Springbank coming along, some Ardbeg coming along. There's some Lafroigs coming along. There's some Beaumont coming along, and I think some Highland Park.
One thing that I found out about is that, in the past, we've seen distilleries that will include a CD with a bottle of whiskey as a way to get you to buy the whiskey. But I've never heard of a CD being sold with a bottle of whiskey as the premium. And I guess that's what Robin Lang is up to now with his new Brooklady CD.
With Robin, as you know, is a great performer, and he's written several songs about Brookladdy over the last decade, six of them, in fact. And he's, we thought, you know, for this purpose, we would put them onto one CD. So we have a Brookladdy Robin Lang CD of six different songs of his. Some of them are, you know, as usual, quite tongue-in-cheek. So that's what we've done. It's called Inspiration, Robin Lang's Inspiration. It'll be available on our website, our new website, which I'd hoped would be ready for this weekend, but it won't be for another sort of 3 weeks or so. But a rather dramatic new website for Brookladdy, and you'll be able to buy it on that.
Robin Lang is performing at the Distillery this weekend. And in addition to the Brookladdy CD, his new CD, Whiskey for Breakfast, is available now. I caught up with Robin at his home before he left for Islay.
I keep producing whiskey songs, and when I feel I've got enough, then maybe that's a CD. This is my fourth whiskey CD. A little bit unusually, it's 15 songs all written by me, so I definitely had enough. And one of the songs is called Whiskey for Breakfast, and I just thought that would be quite an intriguing title. a little bit contentious, of course, in this modern day of responsible drinking and all the rest of it, but I make it quite clear in my sleeve notes that I don't regularly have whiskey for breakfast.
But in theory, it's always 5 o'clock somewhere, as the song goes, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I've used that one myself.
Give me an idea of some of the songs that are on this one.
Well, there are three songs that I wrote really for the album, because I wasn't convinced that one or two of the songs were strong enough, to make it. But my producer, when he heard them, he's got a musical ear, whereas I have a words ear, you know. And he saw musical potential in the ones that I felt were lyrically not that strong. And there's nothing wrong with simple songs, you know, they have a certain immediate appeal. So anyway, at the time when we were planning the album, I thought maybe I could do with one or two more. So I sat down and started three new songs, and they turned out, interestingly, to be some of the stronger tracks on the album. I don't know whether that tells you anything. One of them is called Talisker Bay. One's called Special Sippin' Whiskey, and the other one is Black Art.
So, and speaking of Black Art, I know you're performing at Brookladdy again this weekend at the festival, of course. Tell me about
right.
The CD that you're doing with Brookladdy, because it's the first time I know of where a bottle of whiskey is coming with a CD instead of the other way around.
Yeah, it's a little bit unusual. This album, Whiskey for Breakfast, has three songs on it that are about Brookladdy. There's Black Art, which is one of their expressions. There's a song called the Brookladdy Dram, which claims that if whatever's going wrong in your life, the answer is a Brookladdy Dram. And then there's a song, the first track on the album, called A Turquoise Frame of Mind, which interestingly doesn't mention whiskey at all, but anybody who knows that turquoise is the corporate colour of Brookladdy will know what this song is about. So there's three Brookladdy songs on this CD, and I've already recorded three others. So I suggested to them that since we now had a half a dozen songs, it might be worth putting them together. And they thought it was a wonderful idea, because they're 10 years old this year, and their celebration on Sunday coming is going to be quite an important, bigger than usual celebration, I think. So we decided to make the album, which really is it's their thing. They're going to make this album with a very nice cover, with a license to lift the tracks from the other CDs, all by Green Tracks. And they'll use it as a promotional tool, really. I mean, whether they'll just give it to people that they know and like, or whether they'll give it away with a bottle of whiskey, or whether they'll, you know, send it off to their customers overseas, I don't know what they'll do with it, but anyway, they've ordered a couple of thousand copies, so they must have some plan for it. And they invited me to come and choose a cask in the warehouse, and the idea is that the bottles from that cask will have a label that matches the CD, and they're both called Inspiration, which is quite appropriate, really.
How much inspiration do you get from whiskey when you are writing your songs?
I suppose in a way the inspiration comes from various sources. I mean, I used to joke that the process in Scotland is distillation, evaporation, inspiration. It's in the air so much that it gets into the Scots psyche, and maybe that's why we have so many good poets and writers and musicians. I don't know, but it's possible. And then, of course, there's the direct inspiration of the way you feel so mellow when you have a pleasant glass of whiskey that that sometimes that just works wonders. But for me, it's more about the stories. I love the history and culture of whiskey and the stories that come with it. And when you start to look at some of these stories, you know, for example, the story about the black art, Jim McEwan saying that the art of the distiller is very similar to that of the necromancer, producing magical potions and the elixir of life and so on. So I just took that idea. And his secrecy also, very unusual for Jim, but his secrecy about, you know, the provenance of the casks that Black Heart whiskey came from. Normally, Bruichladdie are quite keen to tell you on the bottle where it came from. Not just where it was most of its life, but what it was aced in, and aced is another word for finishing. Additional cask enhancement, for those who don't know.
And we're not going to let Jim hear this before you go down there, because he'll beat you for using the word finishing this weekend if he hears about it.
Well, that's what other people call it. acing just needs a little bit of explanation. So that was the story behind Black Art. Was I thought, let's take that enigmatic secrecy and the potions that can have a mind-altering, life-altering effect, and play around with it. And so that's what I did.
Where can people get the Whiskey for Breakfast CD?
Well, it should be available on the internet quite easily. Amazon, I guess. There are one or two specialist music selling companies in Scotland. There's Foot Stompin' has a CD, a site on the internet. MusicScotland.com is another one. And there's a shop called Coda Music, which has a wonderful facility that you can listen to the first 20 seconds of any track on any CD that they have. So, you know, that's a nice way to... They've almost found a way to browse, you know, on the internet, which is something that you miss if you're used to going into record shops or CD shops.
And you can order it through your website as well, right?
Through my website, yeah. You can't buy it directly on my website, but you can order it. Or it's available at various outlets in this country and CD shops or distillery shops even, here and there. But the internet's a reliable place to go for it. I mean, if you were at the Isla Festival this week coming, for example, I'm sure they'll be selling it in the Bruichladdie shop and maybe one or two other places as well. But if anybody's stuck, send me an email. Go to my website, robinlane.com, and send me an email.
Whiskey for Breakfast isn't available yet through iTunes or Amazon in the U.S. But here's a cut from his Bruichladdie CD, appropriately titled Bruichladdie.
One day as I was walking by the shores of Loch Endoll, I met a man with sadness in his eye. His story was as haunted as the lonely seabird's call, and he told me of the day he wept and walked away as he watched the fire at Bruichladdie die. He told me of a place that once would never sleep, with hiss of steam and clang and furnace roar, and how that sleeping beauty lies trapped in slumber deep, with moonbeams full of dust and gates in chains of rust and ghosts that wander the Bruichladdie floor. And the moon smiles kindly on the western seas, perfume tumbles on the midnight breeze. And standing on the island of distilleries, you can almost see the coast of heaven. Here I stand again, after years have gone by, with a Bruach laddie in my hand once more. It reminds me of the magic of a moonlit sky, the way it catches light, smells of summer nights, and the sea that touches the Bruach laddie shore. And the moon smiles kindly on the western seas, perfume tumbles on the midnight breeze. And standing on the island of distilleries, you can almost see the coast of heaven. So I'll drink to the men who saw a tiny spark and thought that they could turn it to a flame. The men who chased a dream and dragged it from the dark to see the light of day and fought to find a way to bring new meaning to the Bruach laddie name. And the moon smiles kindly on western seas, perfume tumbles on the midnight breeze. Standing on the island of distilleries, you can almost see the coast of heaven. You can almost see the coast of heaven.
This week's rain washed the pollen out of the air here in Haddonfield. I've been able to start nosing whiskeys from my sample table again. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with the Old Pulteney 30-year-old. It's bottled at 44% ABV. The nose is lemony with toasted oak, berries, and dried flowers. The taste is warming with notes of honey, cinnamon, tea with lemon, and long-lasting. The finish is spicy and lingering with just a hint of dark chocolate. I'm giving the Old Pulteney 30-year-old a score of 90. Last time around, I mentioned the Auchentoshan 1998 matured in Fino sherry casks. It's bottled at 54.6% ABV. The nose has notes of honey, butterscotch, orange peel, almonds, and a touch of dried flowers. The taste is sweet and citrusy tart with hints of lemon, mango, pineapple, and a touch of green apples that carries into the finish, which is a bit drier than usual. It's consistent and very nice. I'm scoring the Auchentoshan 1998 a 92. Finally, let's look at the English Whiskey Company's Founder's Private Cellar release. It's from the distillery's fifth cask ever filled and was bottled at 61.5% ABV. The nose is light and grassy with touches of allspice, toasted oak, and lemon. The taste is thick, chewy, and spicy with black pepper and cinnamon and hints of honey and lemon underneath. The finish is juicy, mouth-watering, lingering, and lemony tart with a touch of honey. I'm scoring it an 85. I've updated the ratings section of the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps with more tasting notes over the past week. The iPhone and iPad version is sponsored by the Glenrothes. The Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick. My notes are also available at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, and of course the debut of WhiskeyCast HD with Middleton's Jer Buckley. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.